Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Recently, we spoke with the president of Caltech, Jean-Luc Chameau, about why American kids are falling behind in science compared to those in other countries. Did you hear that segment? And we took calls from science teachers and others as to why. And he emphasized that science teachers are trained as education majors in this country, not scientists. We'll play that clip in a little while. And we also talked about America's humanities-oriented culture, individualism, and expression over what might seem to be the boring, depersonalized rigor of the sciences. Well, we will get another view now from the authors of a new book called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And the authors are a journalist and a scientist, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, a marine scientist and research associate at Duke University, and Chris Mooney, whose previous bestseller was called The Republican War on Science. They see a divide between science and society in politics, the media, the entertainment industry, and religion, and we'll touch on all of those. So Cheryl, Chris, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Good to be here.
And Chris, just so people know where you're coming from, since I cited the title of your previous bestseller, we know how the previous administration let politics trump science on global warming and maybe a few other things. That's been well documented. But hearing the title of your last book, The Republican War on Science, might sound like you think scientific illiteracy is a partisan agenda. How much is that what you argue?
Well, certainly politics does interfere with science in a dramatic way. And with the last administration, it was egregious, and that's what I argued. But you can certainly find misuse of science on the political left, too, and that was even fully discussed in the Republican War on Science. And we talk about, in the book, for example, the people who don't trust vaccines and how their views are not based in good science, and also how it tends to be a movement that's on the political left.
The subtitle of your book, Chris, is how, or Cheryl, I should say, is how scientific illiteracy threatens our future. So I'll bite, and we'll get back to media and religion and these other hot buttons. But maybe it's good at the outset to, you know, establish, to go from microscope to telescope. What's the long view of what's at stake?
Well, our future, all of our futures and our children and our grandchildren. Science is central to so many of the 21st century's greatest threats, and yet it almost seems like a special interest group or sort of side issue when we talk about a lot of them and how they impact our lives. So I think the central thesis of the book is making science more of a common culture for all of us.
And I know now we're going to get a lot of angry calls and emails from people who are skeptical of vaccinations because of what you said, Chris. So
Sorry. Do
you want to go into that a little bit more? I know that's in the book.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just one of many topics where you have, on the one hand, a pretty strong scientific consensus view. It's been looked at. Does Tamiflu, which has now been removed from vaccines, did it cause an epidemic of autism? And the studies just don't show it. But nevertheless, you have a strong contingent of people who do not accept the studies. You have Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey and a lot of celebrities who don't accept the studies.
But science, as you well know, science is complex. And I think the way to accurately frame the state of that particular research is there has been no scientific evidence found to date to implicate the Tamiflu in autism. However, there has been no other finding to demonstrate what does cause it. And so it's all an open book because nothing's really been ruled in or ruled out.
That's true, too. So we do see the incidence of autism apparently rising, and there's a big debate over how much it's changing diagnostic procedures and how much it might be some environmental cause. And that's the background against which the whole vaccine debate plays out now. But in that context, again, we have looked at vaccines and tried to see if they are the cause. And scientists have grown pretty confident that they're not.
Listeners, call in. And we're not going to make this about the Tamiflu, but call in about our scientific illiteracy in general. 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692 for Cheryl Kirschenbaum and Chris Mooney, authors of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And Cheryl, this book does address a rift between science and religion as one cause of our scientific illiteracy. How far do you want to take that? Does it go beyond certain fundamentalists trying to stop the teaching of evolutionary biology?
Well, it's a much bigger issue than that. And I think, like, in my case, it's very simple. I'm interested in conservation science, science policy, and we need as many people to be a part of these conversations as possible. So when science is presented by certain just very vocal voices to be completely intolerant of all religion, which is not at all representative of science at large, we're turning a lot of people off to the discussion. And in an age where we have to talk about climate change and acidification and things that are sort of fundamental to all of us, we need to stop doing that. So we think obviously that creationism should not be taught in the classroom, and you know, evolution needs to be part of everyone's education. But I think that it would be great to make science more inclusive and not always alienate other groups.
But you also write that the new atheist, well, I guess this is what you were just saying, really, that the new atheism movement is counterproductive to the interest of scientific literacy.
Yes, I worked as my for my graduate thesis on fishing boats, and it took a very long time for me to work with these very, you know, good-natured, terrific guys who just thought I was completely against everything they stood for, because that was the impression they had from the outside of what science does. It was only through kind of interpersonal conversations and getting to know each other and hanging out outside of just standing on boats and working together, that we got to know each other as people. So if anything, I'd like to see a human face put on science that's not just kind of one ideology versus another.
And Chris, the book says perhaps the biggest single threat to the role of science in American culture is the disconnect between scientists and journalists. Why journalists?
Well, they are supposed to be the conduit of scientific information from the community of researchers to the broader society, and it has always been a difficult handoff of information because science is complicated and most journalists don't know how to cover it, except for the science journalists. And it's gotten even more complicated because, as we document in the book, science journalists, in the context of the implosion of the newspaper industry and the media more generally, they're all losing their jobs. So the people who once knew how to explain science to broader audiences are now not really valued in the context of having to make big newsroom cuts.
And I'm curious, since you're a journalist, Chris, right? Your training is in journalism?
Yeah.
And you're a marine biologist, Cheryl?
Yes.
And so as a scientist and a journalist writing this book together, did you find yourself in any culture clashes or approaching the same problem in different ways? Cheryl, anything like that?
Well, you know, it was incredibly interesting just writing alongside Chris, because I'm used to writing articles where we use a past tense. We write a certain way. We don't use analogies and metaphors. Very basic stuff, but stuff that I just wasn't necessarily thinking about all the time. So kind of to come at it with Chris has been a really, really interesting collaboration for me and improved my skills, I hope, as a journalist. And I think I've taught you a thing or two about science, too, Chris.
Yeah, I edit sometimes, and I'm like, no more wonk language. Stop being such a nerd. And so I have to, you know.
No analogies and metaphors, Cheryl. Scientists are, that's drilled out of scientists because those aren't evidence-based. Those are kind of the mind.
I think it's just we have a very specific writing style when we submit to journals, and journals, of course, aren't freely and publicly available, which is another part of this problem. So, sort of to access these, you get caught up in the world of academia. We have a chapter about this in the book. And the way we train scientists is to talk to each other. We end up having a lot of sort of academic circles where we're used to having the same conversations with the same groups all the time. And then, you know, I went on to work in science policy circles. I was working on the Hill with Senator Bill Nelson, and I really, at that point, had to change my communication style because I couldn't whittle down, you know, a huge report into anything less than a page of bullet points, and it had to be, you know, what it is, why it matters, and how it's relevant to that particular office. And through that experience, I became increasingly interested in a different way to communicate science.
Beth in Deal, you're on WNYC. Hi, Beth. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I remember also from your last segment, it's really interesting for me because I'm a high school teacher. I actually teach humanities. I teach English and language arts. Which, like you guys have been saying, maybe has taken over the science and math focus in our society. But I think the reason is that the humanities tend to be more relevant, or humanities teachers tend to take the job on of making the issues relevant and relatable to the students. And I think science teachers need to do that as well. And I know in the school that I work in, which, on the side point, is actually an Orthodox Jewish school, which does teach evolution and does teach, you know, of issues like stem cell research and things like that. We have an elective in our school called Applied Science, which after 2 or 3 years of basic science like biology and chemistry incorporates what the students have learned in the basics into the applications of those sciences in the real day-to-day world, how these sciences apply to them and are relevant to them and will be relevant to the, our world in general.
And I'm so glad that, oh, you've got a little science project of your own going there, a little biology experiment.
Okay, she'll be okay.
So I want to play for you, Beth, as well as our guests, the clip that I referred to earlier of the president of Caltech, Jean-Luc Chameau, about the difference between Asia and Europe and the United States on how science teachers are educated.
In Asia and most of Western Europe, the large majority of science teachers are people who are educated in science, have degrees in physics, in mathematics, in chemistry, and I think they find ways to excite young people and show them that, how cool and exciting science can be. In this country, it is the reverse. The large majority of our teachers have not received a deep education in science.
So, Beth and Deal, as a teacher, do you relate to that, or do you kind of resent the fact that he's saying in order to be a good science teacher, you have to be a scientist rather than a professional educator?
No, I actually, again, as a high school teachers tend to be more experts in their field.
Correct.
You know, the English teachers tend to be writers or journalists. The science teachers tend to have science-related jobs outside of school. But I also remember that middle school, from your previous segment, that middle school was more of an issue because middle school teachers are educators, which is a great thing because educators need to have techniques in middle school to get through to the students. But I think all teachers need to be able to bring their subject out of a vacuum and into the children's lives. And again, as humanities teachers, I think we take that for granted.
Beth,
when we're talking about Hamlet, we're talking about a teenage boy who's angry at his parents.
Thank you very much for your call. It's really important. And, you know, in fact, Cheryl, after we had that conversation on the air previously and the importance of middle school teachers came up because people thought it was, we had all these high school teachers calling in, science teachers, who said, it's too late when I get them. Because middle schools don't have people trained in the sciences teaching science. And so they're already turned off to science. And then I went home and someone said to me, we have that clip? Oh, okay. Well, here it is. Here's a high school science teacher from that same show with the president of Caltech.
Middle school is crucial. It is because when the children come out of primary school, they still have the love of science. They're interested in it. By the time they get to middle school, we don't have the teachers who have the background to teach science.
And then Cheryl Kirschenbaum, someone said to me at home that night, no, you really have to start even earlier in elementary school because most people who go into elementary ed are interested mostly in teaching kids to read, and science is really given a back seat. What do you think of any of this?
Well, Brian, I think this is all absolutely on target. But I have yet to find a six-year-old that isn't a natural-born scientist. I mean, kids, you know, you talk about dinosaurs and space, and they get excited. And for me, it was the same thing by the time I got through high school. After middle school, you know, science was equations and pipetting and all of these things that weren't relevant. Fortunately, in my case, I was really lucky and had that teacher in college that made science relevant again. But there certainly, you know, is a need to keep the candle burning throughout middle school and beyond. Certainly when we're talking about numbers, we're constantly hearing the K-12, and the K-12 education is incredibly important. But in terms of the number of scientists graduating in this country, it's actually higher than ever. So the retention problem for training scientists isn't necessarily, we're not losing people who might return to it later. But what we are maybe losing is a broader public engagement in science at an early age that should kind of continue to live on throughout their lives and make them, you know, want to be part of these conversations that we're hearing about on TV about things like vaccines and climate change.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we talk to the authors of a new book called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy threatens our future. They are Cheryl Kirschenbaum, a marine biologist and research associate at Duke University, and Chris Mooney, whose previous bestseller was called The Republican War on Science. And Nick in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Brian. I'd just like to say that I think a lot of distrust of modern science among modern adults might stem from the fact that a lot of American scientific research is funded and driven by special interest groups such as Big Pharma and defense and all that stuff. So people, I think a lot of people tend to distrust scientific research about vaccines, for example, because they just don't trust where it's coming from, and they feel that it comes from places which have a special interest in a scientific result coming out a certain way.
Chris Mooney, what do you think of that?
I think that that is part of the actual fall from grace of narrative of modern science in America, where, you know, in the 50s and 60s, we really trusted science to solve all of our problems, and then we realized, oh, my God, you know, we've released chlorofluorocarbons into the atmosphere. We've put DDT out into the world, and we started to wonder, oh, not everything that science does is so great. And that is with us now, and it will be with us, I think, forever. But nevertheless, when you poll Americans, they still have positive views about the ability of science to improve our lives. It's more that they're not engaged with science and actually how it's practiced day to day than that they're really skeptical of corporate science.
Nick, that was really well put. Thank you for that call. Well, here's a great comment from our webpage, Cheryl, about teaching styles, which we were talking about before. This says, my high school physics teacher's motto was chug and plug. She drilled us on formulas, guided us through workbook problems in which we just had to pick the right formula, and, quote, then chug and plug. I memorized the gravitational constant, all right, but we never talked about what gravity is or how it works or why it's important. I couldn't wait to get to college and swear off science in favor of humanities courses where I would be allowed to think for myself. And then this person concludes, a decade later, I'm a radio lab junkie, that's our science show, and wish I could travel back in time to visit my 18-year-old self and say, take the astrophysics, take the neuroscience, you'll love it. But that chug and plug, memorize the formula and spit it out.
Exactly. I was a victim of chug and plug, too. I wholeheartedly empathize with that. I don't think it's ever too late to kind of reintroduce yourself to science, as this person clearly has, but we do need to get past that and change the way that we have these conversations and talk about it. Make it fun again.
John from Waterside Plaza, you're on WNYC. John, you're on the air.
I can be confident.
John, you're on the air. John.
You know, so they don't have to worry. So the more they don't have to worry about,
should
the
we
more
listen
they
in
can
on,
be able to tolerate
on his conversation?
What? You know.
Or would he like to join ours? John, last chance. You're on the air.
I'm going to make an appointment.
She's trying to make an appointment. Okay, forget it. all right, we got through three of your topics. We got through the problems with the media, religion, and politics and science. So let's finish with the last one, which is pop culture and the entertainment industry. How do they contribute to scientific illiteracy, Chris?
Well, I think this is a really big, important part of the story because we have polling data suggesting that just 18% of Americans know a scientist personally. So everybody else is going on some kind of stereotype. And where are they getting it from? They're getting it from pop culture, the entertainment industry, where for a very long time the scientist character has been the nerd in the white coat, or the scientist character has been the Dr. Evil about to destroy the world. So these depictions are recurrent. Kids get them, and that's what they think scientists are.
John in Waterside, by the way, wanted to say, can we give him another chance? Is he there? I'll give him one more chance if he's there right now. He's not. He wanted to say the left also, since you wrote about Republicans versus science, he said the left also on global warming is anti-science because they want to tell us all that it's settled science. And there's no such thing as settled science. Cheryl, does he have a point?
Well, the extreme consensus in the scientific community is that global warming has a human-induced cause. And I think that when you kind of look at the how quickly the climate has changed in, you know, the past several decades, we can see that regardless of the cause, we need to probably enact some new policies to mitigate what's going on and sort of lessen the problems that we're going to see down the line. And, you know, in my case, I do ocean science, so I'm extremely concerned about acidification. And it shouldn't even matter why it's happening, why it's not happening. What should matter is that we want to preserve coral and clownfish and all of these terrific species.
But
to
there's
be
a lot, sure, but there's a lot that's not settled, isn't there, in fairness? We don't really know how fast. We don't really know what the effects are going to be. We don't know the percentage of the effect that's caused by human beings, although there doesn't seem to be much real, you know, disagreement over the fact that it is. But we don't know if we're going to be 2 degrees higher in 20 years, 5 degrees higher in 30 years. There is a lot that's unsettled, right? And the outcomes of that.
But we are observing some very frightening changes. We're observing, you know, dramatic bleaching events. We're observing fish that are changing their behavior based on, you know, changes in the acidity of the oceans. We're seeing all these things happening.
So you can start to plot a curve.
You can start to plot a curve, and more than that, you can start enacting policy, you know, not making it this partisan debate on either side, but looking towards solutions and trying to get the best information out there from an honest broker.
Cheryl Kirshenbaum, marine biologist, Chris Mooney, journalist, are authors of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Thanks for writing the book. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us.
Good to be with you.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. In a minute, why there's conflict over a development project in Williamsburg that people actually want. Stay with us.